A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He opened a bottle of red wine the other night, something that slipped past what he calls the usually stringent inspection process, and it was semi-dry. He says it tasted like opening a bottle of Coca-Cola. Flat, cloying, just wrong. And it got him asking, what objectively distinguishes a dry wine from a semi-dry or sweet one? And are there specific red grapes or varieties that reliably deliver that unapologetically dry, bold experience for people who want their wine to stay in its lane?
That Coca-Cola comparison is vivid, and it's not as hyperbolic as it sounds. I mean, chemically, we can actually measure exactly how far apart they are, but the sensation of betrayal when you're expecting something bone dry and get hit with residual sugar, that's real. It's a physiological jolt.
It's the gap between what the label promised and what the liquid actually delivered. And for people who genuinely love dry red wine, not as a posture, but as a preference, that gap feels like a broken contract. You know that moment when you take a sip and your brain just, not because the wine is objectively bad, but because it's wrong for what you thought you were buying.
And Daniel's self-description here is interesting. He loves dry red wine and dry cider, but he also loves Coca-Cola and sweets. So it's not a blanket aversion to sugar, it's that he wants each thing to stay in its lane. Sweet things should be sweet. Dry things should be dry. The offense isn't sweetness itself, it's sweetness showing up where it doesn't belong.
Which is more precise than most people are about their own palates. Most folks just say, I don't like sweet wine, and leave it there. Daniel's actually identified the boundary problem. It's category confusion, not a sugar phobia.
That's a much more interesting question to dig into, because it forces us to ask, what does dry actually mean? Is it a number? Is it a sensation? Is it just a marketing word that's been stretched until it's meaningless?
That's the core of it. You walk into a wine shop, you see dry on a label, and you assume it means something objective. But the experience Daniel had, opening a bottle labeled dry and getting something that reminded him of flat soda, suggests the word is doing less work than we think.
Where do we even start with this?
I think we start with the chemistry. Because there is an objective metric underneath all this, it's just that almost nobody talks about it on the bottle.
That's the thing that frustrates me about wine marketing. You've got this perfectly measurable quantity, residual sugar, grams per liter, a number you can get from a lab in about 10 minutes, and instead of putting it on the label, the industry gives you a word that's been legally stretched and perceptually muddied until it barely means anything.
The objective metric exists, but the consumer never sees it. The word dry is a term of art, like Daniel said, not a metric. It's like if milk cartons just said cold instead of giving you a temperature.
That's exactly the right analogy. And what makes it worse is that Daniel's preference framework, things staying in their lane, is actually more scientifically coherent than most wine marketing. He's not anti-sugar. He drinks Coca-Cola, which clocks in at about 108 grams of sugar per liter. He eats sweets. The man has clearly identified that the problem isn't sweetness, it's category violation.
I like that. It's the same reason you don't put ketchup on ice cream. Both are fine separately. Together, they're a crime.
And that's what this episode is really about. Not just which wines are dry, but the gap between a subjective preference that's actually quite well defined and an industry that refuses to give you the numbers to satisfy it. We're going to look at the chemistry, sure, but the bigger question is why the science and the marketing are so misaligned.
The project here is, take a preference Daniel can articulate clearly, bold, unapologetically dry red wine, and trace it back to what's actually happening in the glass. Then figure out which grapes and regions deliver that experience reliably, so the next bottle doesn't ambush him.
I think the place to start is with that little molecule we keep dancing around. Because once you understand how it works, and more importantly, how acid and tannins change the way you perceive it, the whole dry conversation shifts from subjective to something you can actually shop for. Residual sugar is measured in grams per liter, and the legal definitions are surprisingly loose. In the European Union, a wine can be labeled dry if it has less than 4 grams per liter of residual sugar. In the United States, the threshold is 10 grams per liter. That's more than double. So a wine that's legally dry in California could be legally off-dry in France.
The word dry on an American bottle is already covering a range wide enough to drive a truck through. 10 grams per liter. What does that actually taste like?
That's the thing. It depends entirely on what else is in the glass. 10 grams of sugar in a high-acid wine might be imperceptible. In a low-acid wine, it can feel like someone stirred in a teaspoon of jam. The perception of sweetness isn't just about how much sugar is present. It's about whether the acid and tannins are there to counterbalance it.
Dry is a sensation, not a number. That's almost frustrating to hear, because it means you can't just memorize a cutoff and be done with it.
Acid is the main mask. Think of lemonade. Wine works the same way. A Riesling with 5 grams per liter of residual sugar can taste bone dry if the acid is high enough. Meanwhile, a low-acid red with only 2 grams per liter can taste sweet because there's nothing pushing back against the sugar.
You could have 2 wines with identical residual sugar numbers, and one tastes dry while the other tastes sweet, purely because of the acid profile. That's wild.
Tannins add another layer of masking, that grippy, mouth-drying sensation you get from a big red that's physically competing with the sweetness signal.
How does that actually work, physiologically? What's happening in your mouth?
Tannins are polyphenolic compounds that bind to proteins in your saliva, specifically proline-rich proteins. When they bind, they precipitate out, which reduces the lubricating film on your tongue and creates that astringent drying sensation. It's literally the opposite of the slick, coating feeling you get from sugar. So a wine with high tannins and high acid can have several grams of residual sugar and still read as dry because those two elements are actively suppressing the sweetness perception. It's a three-way tug of war in your mouth.
Which brings us back to Daniel's Coca-Cola moment. He said the semi-dry red tasted like flat soda. Let's put numbers on that.
Coca-Cola has about 108 grams of sugar per liter. A typical semi-dry red wine is in the range of 15 to 30 grams per liter of residual sugar. So Daniel's offending bottle was somewhere between 1/7 and 1/3 as sweet as actual Coke. That's not soda-level sugar. But for someone whose palate is calibrated to expect something under 4 grams per liter, that jump is enormous.
It's the category violation again. His brain was primed for dry red wine, which in his experience means negligible sugar, and instead it got a sweetness spike that, while objectively far below soda, was wildly out of place for the context. It's like ordering black coffee and getting something with 2 sugars in it. The absolute sweetness isn't the issue. The mismatch is.
Here's where it gets even trickier. Alcohol complicates the signal. Higher alcohol wines, say 14 to 16% ABV, can create a perception of sweetness on their own. Ethanol has a slightly sweet taste, and the warmth or heat of high alcohol can read as richness that the brain sometimes interprets as sweetness. So you can have a wine with technically low residual sugar that still feels sweet because the alcohol is high and the acid is low.
You've got 4 variables all pulling in different directions. Residual sugar, acid, tannins, and alcohol. And the word dry is supposed to summarize that entire interaction.
It fails constantly. Take a Nebbiolo from Barolo. Residual sugar often under 1 gram per liter, essentially 0. Tannins are massive, acid is high, alcohol is moderate to high. That wine tastes dry in a way that feels structural, almost architectural. There's nothing soft or sweet about it.
Versus a Zinfandel from a warm California vintage, legally dry at maybe 5 grams per liter of residual sugar. But the acid is lower, the tannins are softer, and the alcohol can push 15 or 16%. That wine is legally dry, but it tastes ripe, jammy, almost sweet. Same word on the label, completely different experience.
That's the trap Daniel fell into. He bought a bottle that said dry, probably had something in the 15 to 30 gram range, and his palate immediately flagged it as wrong. He wasn't being picky. His brain was correctly detecting a chemical reality that the label had obscured.
If you're shopping for what Daniel wants, that unapologetically dry, bold experience, the word dry on the label is almost useless. You need to triangulate. Low residual sugar, high acid, high tannins. The label won't give you the numbers, but it will give you clues. Region, grape variety, alcohol percentage. Those are the proxies.
That's where we need to go next. Because now that we understand the mechanism, the four-way balance, and how easily the word dry can lie, we can talk about which grapes and which regions actually deliver the experience. Daniel's after, reliably, without ambushing him.
Let's talk grapes. If Daniel wants that structural, unapologetically dry experience, which variety should he be reaching for?
Cabernet Sauvignon is the obvious starting point. It's the workhorse of dry red wine for a reason. Naturally high in both tannins and acid, and when it's grown in the right place, the residual sugar is negligible. A classic left bank Bordeaux, which is predominantly Cabernet Sauvignon, will often ferment completely dry, below 2 grams per liter. The structure comes from the grape itself, not from winemaking tricks.
That's the catch, isn't it? Grown in the right place. A Napa Valley Cabernet from a warm vintage can hit 15% alcohol, get jammy, and lose that dry edge even if the sugar number is technically low.
That's exactly the old world versus new world trap. A Bordeaux from a cooler vintage will taste leaner, more structured, more obviously dry. A Napa Cab from a ripe year, same grape, same legal category, can feel almost sweet because the alcohol is high and the fruit is so concentrated. The alcohol creates that perception of sweetness we talked about, even if the residual sugar is zero. So if Daniel wants reliability, he should look at Bordeaux, not Napa.
What about Nebbiolo? You mentioned Barolo earlier. That sounds like the extreme end of what Daniel's after.
Nebbiolo is the king. Residual sugar routinely under 1 gram per liter. The tannins are enormous. I mean, a young Barolo can feel like it's stripping the enamel off your teeth. High acid, moderate alcohol, and a kind of austerity that's the opposite of jammy. It's unapologetic in exactly the way Daniel described. The catch is that it needs age. A young Nebbiolo can be so tannic it's punishing.
Patience is part of the price. You're not cracking open a Barolo the night you buy it and having a pleasant evening.
No, you're having a fistfight with a bottle. But that's part of the appeal for some people. What about Syrah?
Syrah from the Northern Rhone, think Hermitage or Côte Rôti, is another reliable pick. It's peppery, savory, high in tannins, and typically fermented dry. Cool climate Syrah has the smoky, meaty quality with none of the sweetness you'd get from a warm climate Shiraz. Same grape, by the way. Syrah and Shiraz are genetically identical. But a Barossa Valley Shiraz from Australia is often ripe, high alcohol, and can taste almost sweet, while a Northern Rhone Syrah is bone dry and savory. The difference is entirely climate and winemaking.
The rule of thumb is, same grape, cooler climate, more reliable dryness. It's almost like a cheat code. If you see Syrah on a label from a cool region, you're probably safe. If you see Shiraz from a hot region, you're rolling the dice.
Then there's Tannat. This is the most tannic red grape in the world, measured at up to 5,000 milligrams per liter of tannins, according to a study in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. For context, that's roughly double what you'd find in a typical Cabernet. It's grown mostly in Madeiran, in southwest France, and in Uruguay. A traditional Madeiran is about as dry and structured as red wine gets. If Daniel wants something that feels like it's actively fighting back against sweetness, Tannat is the answer.
I love that image. A wine that fights back. So Cabernet Sauvignon from Bordeaux, Nebbiolo from Barolo, Syrah from the Northern Rhone, and Tannat from Madeiran. Those are the reliable anchors.
Here's a wrinkle Daniel might not have considered. Winemaking technique matters almost as much as the grape. Oak aging, especially new oak, adds vanillin and toast compounds that can mimic sweetness on the palate. You're not tasting sugar, but your brain reads those vanilla notes and thinks, sweet. A wine fermented and aged in stainless steel or neutral oak won't have that effect. The pure, dry expression of the grape comes through without the confectionery overlay.
Even a grape that should be dry can get muddied by the barrel. This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. You do your homework, you pick the right grape from the right region, and then the winemaker throws it in new American oak for 18 months, and suddenly it tastes like a vanilla milkshake.
If you don't know to look for that, you're back to feeling ambushed. What's the tell on the label? Are there code words for heavy oak treatment?
Sometimes you'll see aged in new French oak or barrel fermented, which are flags. But often, it's not disclosed at all. You have to learn the producers. And this parallels Daniel's cider preference perfectly. Dry cider typically has less than 1 gram per liter of residual sugar. Semi-dry cider is in the 10 to 20 gram range. The confusion is identical. Same word, different sugar loads, and the label rarely tells you which one you're getting. He's navigating the same problem in 2 different beverage categories.
Which means the solution is probably the same in both cases. Ignore the marketing word and look for the proxies. Alcohol percentage. Lower is often drier, counterintuitively. Region. Cooler climates trend drier. And grape variety. Some are just structurally built for it.
One more practical tip. There are producers who put the residual sugar number on the label or the text sheet on their website. It's rare, but it's growing. Apps like Vivino let you filter by user ratings where people specifically flag whether a wine drinks dry, and honestly, the simplest move is to ask at the wine shop. If the person behind the counter can tell you the residual sugar level, you're in good hands. If they look at you like you've asked for the wine's blood type, shop somewhere else.
If you're actually standing in a wine shop, staring at a shelf, what do you do with all this? You ignore the word dry on the label. It's noise. Instead, look at 3 things. Alcohol percentage. Lower is often a better bet, which sounds backwards, but high alcohol can sweeten the perception. Region. Old world. Cooler climates. Places where grapes struggle to ripen. And the grape itself. Cabernet Sauvignon. Nebbiolo. Syrah. Tannat. If you see those 3 things aligning, you're probably in safe territory.
The alcohol point is worth underlining because it confuses people. You see a 15% Napa cab and think big, bold, must be dry. But that warmth from the ethanol can read as sweetness, especially if the acid isn't there to cut it. A 12.5% Bordeaux often drinks drier than a 15% California cab, even if both have 0 residual sugar.
That's completely counterintuitive. People associate higher alcohol with bigger wine, and they assume bigger means drier. But the physics of it goes the other way.
And the second thing Daniel can do is train his own palate to stop trusting the marketing copy and start trusting the acid tannin structure. Taste 2 wines side by side that you know have different residual sugar levels. Once you've felt the difference between a Barolo with under 1 gram per liter and something with 5 or 6 grams, your mouth learns the signal. You stop needing the label to tell you what's happening.
The acid is your compass. If a wine makes your mouth water, if it feels bright and alive on your tongue, the sugar is probably low, because acid and sugar are in opposition. If it feels flat or coating, even if it's technically dry, something's off.
The simplest move of all. Next time you're in a wine shop, ask the person behind the counter what the residual sugar level is on a bottle you're considering. If they can answer, you found a good shop. If they look at you blankly, that's useful information too.
It's a litmus test. Wine professionals who know their inventory can usually give you a number, or at least a range. The ones who can't are probably selling based on the same vague marketing language you're trying to escape. Vote with your wallet for transparency. The more people ask the question, the more incentive producers have to put the number on the label.
The question that sticks with me is whether the industry will ever just put the number on the bottle. Mandatory residual sugar labeling. It's technically trivial, a lab test that costs pennies per batch. But there's enormous resistance to it, because dry as a vague term of art lets winemakers sell a much wider range of products under one comforting word.
If consumers knew the actual grams per liter number, a lot of wines currently labeled dry would suddenly have to explain themselves. That's not a transparency problem the industry seems eager to solve. You'd have wines with 15 grams per liter sitting next to wines with 1 gram per liter, both saying dry, and the jig would be up.
I think the pressure will build anyway. Podcasts, apps, wine forums, people are getting more literate about this stuff. Daniel's bad bottle isn't just a personal disappointment, it's a small data point in a larger shift. Every time someone asks a shop for the residual sugar number and walks out when they can't get it, the incentive structure tilts a little further toward disclosure.
The actionable thing for anyone who's followed us this far is simple. Next time you open a bottle labeled dry, ask yourself, is this actually dry or is it just labeled that way? Your palate probably already knows the answer. Now you've got the framework to trust it.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
For nearly 40 years, marine biologists believed the seamounts off Tierra del Fuego hosted a unique endemic ecosystem isolated since the Cretaceous, until a 1993 expedition revealed the species were identical to those found off New Zealand, having drifted there on Antarctic currents the whole time.
4 decades of scientific consensus, undone by a current.
That's somehow both humbling and reassuring.
Leaves you wondering what else we're wrong about. Wine labeling, probably. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. We're back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.